I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of May. All things political this hour, and our guest is Kathleen Dolan, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin here in Milwaukee. Russ Feingold announcing he's running for his old U.S. Senate seat. Craig Gilbert writes that both Feingold and Ron Johnson see the election as highly competitive. Both think their political differences could not be more fundamental and profound. Senator Elizabeth Warren sent out fundraising emails on Feingold's behalf over the weekend. She has been at the forefront of opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, saying the president has not effectively enforced existing labor standards in prior trade practs. And the president has dismissed her criticisms as dishonest, bunk, and misinformation. 11 Republican hopefuls were in Iowa at the Lincoln Dinner. Jeb Bush was not in Iowa. He, over the weekend, took a tougher stance against same-sex marriage and is still trying to get the answer right on what he would have done in Iraq. Over the weekend, the Islamic State captured Ramadi, which now puts them 80 miles from Baghdad. What do all the candidates have to say about what to do in Iraq now? And Frank Bruni wrote an interesting piece yesterday about Mike Huckabee signing on as a pitchman for a bogus diabetes remedy, Chris Christie being treated by Jordan's King to a weekend of posh partying, Marco Rubio cozying up to a billionaire auto dealer, Hillary and Bill Clinton receiving morbidly obese speaking fees, and Scott Walker's overall net worth, negative $72,500. Bruni said it made him feel a little warm and fuzzy about Scott Walker, and he invited him to lunch in the Times cafeteria, saying the chicken salad sandwich is on me. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Kathleen Dolan about all of these topics and more. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can find us at K Dunn Show. Professor Kathleen Dolan, hello, and thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, happy to join you.
Nice to have you here. Let's start with former Senator Russ Feingold announcing last week his candidacy for his old Senate seat. He has joined Senator Elizabeth Warren opposing a trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the president has been pushing Congress to approve. Is this going to be a big issue in that Senate race and in the presidential race? And why is there such tension between Warren and the president on this issue?
Well, it's hard to say at this point whether the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact will still be an issue in 2016. It will be an issue, you know, to the degree that the presidential candidates that year want to make it one. It may or may not be something that former Senator Feingold comes back to in his campaign if he believes it helps him stake out a bit more of a populist sort of persona. So, you know, unfortunately, next week is a long time in American politics, so I don't know that we can really say much about what's going to be top of the list in 2016. Senator Warren seems to have deeply held and sort of passionately held beliefs about the wrongheadedness of this trade pact or of perhaps, you know, these sorts of trade agreements in general. She does not seem to be afraid to take the president to task and to sort of stake out that left wing of the party. She may believe that these are arguments that need to be voiced, and she really doesn't seem to have the sort of traditional bearing of a first-term senator, you know, quiet, meek, watching from the sidelines. She's, you know, clearly in there to articulate that perspective, which, you know, she may believe doesn't have any other voice.
Let's look at this match again, this rematch, Johnson and Feingold. What are your thoughts about why Feingold lost the last election? What were the factors working against him then, and why do polls indicate, at least at the moment, that he is significantly ahead of the incumbent Senator Johnson?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons that Senator Feingold was defeated in 2010. You know, one of which was obviously, in hindsight, we now know that it was what we political scientists refer to as a wave election in which the Republican Party did very well. in that midterm election all around the country. If we think back, you know, President Obama had been in office for 2 years at that point, perhaps not, you know, as popular with some people as he may have been. We were, you know, embroiled in the healthcare debates at that point. We were seeing, you know, people sort of having that honeymoon period with the presidency start to pale a little bit. And the Republicans did quite well in playing on a lot of the sort of dissatisfaction with the Obama presidency. You know, the sort of visceral hatred was still pretty high. So we know here in Wisconsin particularly, and we know that all around the country, turnout in congressional mid-year elections, midterm elections, is very different than voter turnout is in presidential elections. It's lower, and the composition of the electorate is different. So here in Wisconsin, we know that electorates who turn out in the off-year congressional elections are older, more conservative, more Republican. They tend to come more from outstate than they do from Madison and Milwaukee and some of the population centers. Excuse me. So Senator Feingold, you know, was vulnerable to the political winds at the time. He was vulnerable to an electorate that was much smaller and more Republican. So that is one piece of it. The other piece of it is that he didn't run his best campaign. I think there are people who could look back at 2010 and suggest that Senator Feingold could have run a more vigorous campaign or perhaps a different campaign. You know, now Senator Johnson sort of coming out of nowhere from the political perspective, you know, he hadn't been a politician before. It may be that they sort of underestimated the appeal that that kind of candidate might have. And so now then going into 2016, former Senator Feingold would be facing that presidential year electorate, larger, probably more Democratic, as you may have seen in Craig Gilbert's column or story today. You know, the difference in the 2010 and 2012 electorate in Wisconsin was almost 800, I believe it was 800,000, 200,000 voters. It was some large number I'm blacking out on now. I apologize. So he'll be facing a different group of voters. It will be a more advantageous electorate for a Democratic candidate. He probably will play on themes of Senator Johnson's lack of legislative accomplishment, his seeming to lay out a role as senator as more of an inside party person than a real legislator, and he may also then, you know, try to stake out more of a populist perspective, defense of the middle class kind of campaign, which is very true to his own roots as a politician.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine any issues on which these two may agree? I'm just wondering where their differences are, their most significant, and how profound are their differences?
Well, you know, they probably both like the Packers. They probably, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are a couple of things we could scrape up. But, you know, there really doesn't seem to be much politically. I mean, I do think if we think back to 2010, they, you know, did stake out for the electorate, you know, different positions and different perspectives. The voters had a clear choice in that election. The result was determined in part because that particular electorate, you know, was sort of weighted to make a particular choice. I don't think that they have become any closer. I think that Senator Feingold, you know, he's the same person, but he's in a different place and in a different climate now because, you know, when he voted against the Patriot Act, when he voted against the Iraq War, you know, 8 years ago, those things were not popular positions. With all of the hindsight we're having now and with all of the renewed discussion of whether the Iraq War was a good idea, he may be able to, you know, curry favor with those positions. He may be more attractive to some voters because of those strong stands that he took. So the sort of diametrically opposed nature of the two men hasn't changed and probably won't change. The people to whom they're talking and making their pitch to will change.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Iraq for a moment. You brought that up, and I was really struck by a couple things over the weekend. One is that ISIS, first they're powerful, and then they're not as powerful, and now again they're about 80 miles away from Baghdad. They've taken Ramadi over the weekend. We have Jeb Bush fumbling on an answer as to whether or not he supported his brother. Somebody over the weekend made an interesting point that most Americans are far more concerned about what the next president is going to do about Iraq. And then they cited the results from this poll, which I found surprising, Kathleen, Quinnipiac University poll, saying 62% of Americans support sending ground troops to Iraq to fight the Islamic State. Only 30% are opposed. Do you think the candidates have laid out what their strategy would be on this? And my gosh, this area just keeps persistently, day after day and month after month, remaining so problematic for the world.
Well, you know, as somebody who does a lot of survey research for a living, I am going to suggest that we give the Quinnipiac results just a little bit of measure, you know, before we really believe that 60-odd percent of the public wants us to intervene somehow. You know, polling on those sorts of issues, particularly early in a conflict, is tapping a real emotion. It is not tapping a lot of information necessarily. It's not tapping a lot of strategic thinking. So, you know, we can go back 15 years and we can say, or 12 years, we can say that, you know, polling in the early days of the Iraq war invasion then, you know, looked very similar. So I guess I hope that candidates, you know, don't take that particular position too much to heart yet, because I would like to make sure that the American public is informed and understands and is reminded of, you know, what all of that would take. So I think foreign affairs is a particular place where we don't want to govern by public opinion poll. And so that's just one thing I would say about that. Beyond that, I think that we will see one of the things that's been very interesting over the last 10 or 15 years since September 11th is that terrorism was such a primary issue on the minds of American voters for a long time after September 11th. As we move into 2008, 2009, the economy and Iraq war fatigue, you know, really sort of flip things so that terrorism falls quite far down people's priority list. I think we're now seeing that going to increase again. Depending on how things shake out, you know, we may move into a 2016 climate that is again focused more on international relations than the economy. Again, too early to tell, but I think it's safe to say that that will have a higher visibility. It is interesting that the candidates over the last week or two are focused more on the sort of retrospective look at what we might call the first Iraq invasion, and I think we're just now, you know, really starting to think about what's moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Jeb Bush also, this is an interesting position for him to take, took a much tougher stance against same-sex marriage. He said, what's interesting is 4 years ago, Obama and Clinton had the same view I just expressed to you. It was a Christian broadcasting service. Thousands of years of culture and history is just being changed at warp speed. It's hard to fathom why it is this way. And then he talked about the country's future would be at risk without traditional marriages, to imagine how we're going to succeed in our country unless we have committed family life, committed child-centered family system. It's hard to imagine. We need to be stalwart supporters of traditional marriage. Isn't the country and perhaps the Supreme Court going another way? Why would he say this?
Because he wasn't talking to the country. He was talking to the Republican primary electorate. And I guess I suspect, I don't speak to the former governor often, but I guess I suspect that this is one of those places where he wants to reach out to the sort of true classic Republican electorate, because he takes a different position on some other issues. You know, he's not in line with the traditional Republican primary voter on immigration. He's not in line with that traditional voter on education and Common Core sorts of issues. So it's possible that this is a calculated attempt on his part to articulate a position that he says that he has always had, but to articulate it in a way that says, look, I may part company with you on some issues, but on other issues, I'm right with you. It is interesting, you know, that he is sort of doubling down on where perhaps public opinion was 15 years ago, but that is where a good number of voters in the Republican primary states are still located, and that may be part of his strategy.
Professor Kathleen Dolan is our guest for this week's All Things Political. She's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We're welcoming phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. What do you think about former Senator Russ Feingold deciding that he will enter the race again for his old seat? He will be opposing Senator Ron Johnson, the current incumbent. The polls at this point show that Feingold has a significant advantage. Both candidates are saying that that's likely to get much closer as the race goes on, but they have pretty different political philosophies. So what do you think about that? What do you think about Elizabeth Warren and the president and their clash over trade agreements, and Warren supporting Feingold, saying that she would, well, she said, just the idea of having Russ by my side in the Senate makes me happy. But I don't kid myself. We've got a really, really big fight in front of us for that to happen. I think she was probably referring to the trade agreement. We will talk more about the, you know, people cozying up to huge amounts of money. It's just amazing. Why do politicians feel that they have to do this or charge these huge speaking fees, and yet they say that they have a connection with the average laborer, they feel as though they understand the common person? Do they? Why would you find it a need to charge huge speaking fees or to cozy up to people who are billionaires to help fund a more lavish way of living for you, because a politician's salary isn't enough? I want to talk about that a little bit with Kathleen. So we'll be with your phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Professor Kathleen Dolan is our guest, and we go to Mark in La Crosse for our first call. Hi, Mark. Mark, are you there? All right, I don't know where he is, so let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, as you were talking about money and politics, Honey Fitzgerald, the grandfather of John Kennedy, once talked about the good graft, where political contributions or graft was okay, especially if it was being done to help the constituents. And I was wondering, when we look at the Clinton Foundation and the Koch brothers, are we again going toward the Tammany Hall or the St. Louis type of political machines, where we kind of overlook the graft if we think that it's doing good? And do we really want to go back towards that? Or do we want to get the money out where it leads to like a Nixonian type of presidency? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie, for the call. Professor Dolan.
Well, we are certainly entering an increasingly complex world of campaign finance. There are people who believe that we are sort of headed in a direction, you know, toward another sort of Watergate scandal, which I think Charlie is referring to. There is this increasing escalation, and it's almost like an arms race among candidates to demonstrate that they have the financial support, that they're raising enormous amounts of money. You know, what Charlie is speaking to with regard to how politicians used to use campaign donations and monetary donations to reward followers and supporters and, you know, award jobs and contracts and things like that. You know, I'm not sure. I suppose we probably still do have a lot of that going on in, you know, local and state politics around the country. I'm not sure we would think that we want to choose to return to that sort of thing. You know, we've moved to a civil service system in the United States over the course of the 20th century to try to protect against those things. But, of course, it doesn't mean that, you know, sort of corruption, if you want to use that word, or graft, as Charlie does, doesn't still go on. I'm not sure it's something that we would affirmatively choose if we all sat down as a nation and said, is this the system we want? But I do think that we're going to be seeing and reading more concern about the way that in the post-Citizens United Supreme Court decision world, you know, the sort of perhaps warping influence that money is going to be having, at least at the presidential and congressional levels.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw Frank Bruni's column yesterday, but I thought it was a particularly good one. He was looking essentially at what he called a story of avarice, acquisitiveness, and a resistance to living within the financial bounds of elected office. Mike Huckabee, who's this pitch man for this diabetes remedy that's right. somewhat shady, the Clintons, he cited Bill Clinton making $104.9 million in speaking fees between 2001 and 2013. And he said they're politically on different wavelengths, I think, but making mention of Scott Walker, whose worth is negative $72,500. And some are saying this means he's fiscally irresponsible. I think Bruni said, I'll take him out to lunch in the New York Times cafeteria because, yeah, that kind of warms my heart. This is strange to me to have people saying that they have a connection to everyday Americans. Huckabee talking about connection to laborers who sweat through their clothes, and yet everybody's after this big money, which they probably wouldn't make unless they had some recognition and they had some power. What's going on with all of that? And are people offended by that? Are the everyday people offended by that?
Well, I don't know that there's one answer to that. I think there are some people who are offended by it, and there are probably others who would say that it's sort of the classically American story of going to get it while you can.
Right.
I guess I don't have any public opinion data to support this, but I guess I think people might make some distinctions between people who are currently in office and people who have left office. Certainly, former President Clinton, you know, commands the speaking fees that he does because he was president for 8 years. And clearly the Clinton Foundation attracts the money that it does because of, you know, who runs the foundation. And you know, former Governor Huckabee, after his last attempt at the presidency wasn't successful, and, you know, he was on MSNBC forever, and now he's, you know, writing books and working with pharmaceutical companies and bunny ears. I think people would say, you know, that's his right to earn a living after he has left public office. People may feel differently about those sorts of things than they do about Governor Chris Christie or, you know, other sitting politicians who are accepting all sorts of, you know, lavish treatment and trips and, you know, benefits and sitting in the owner's box, you know, with the Dallas Cowboys and things like that, because maybe that feels to people like those are, you know, public servants who are, you know, sort of personally ingratiating themselves. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think Americans are somewhat schizophrenic on money in politics because we know that it's important. We have allowed the creation of a system in which it is primary. And I think it's probably the case that we let our own partisan view help shape what we think is sort of okay feeding at the trough, and, you know, maybe our opponents feeding at the trough is more troublesome to us.
Does it make someone like Governor Scott Walker at least appear to be more in touch, honestly so, with a common person?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly think that both former President Clinton and former Governor Huckabee remember and believe their roots in small-town Arkansas. I think that, you know, it's certainly not the case that their current status today negates any ability they have to connect to the common person, whatever that is. You know, we can look over the course of American history. We've almost always been ruled by relative elites, and a lot of those people have, you know, former Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia, you know, one of the wealthiest men in the Senate, but spent a lot of his time focused on the issues of poverty in the United States. Kennedy's, you know,
FDR.
And FDR. Yeah. So, you know, we have always been ruled by elites. That doesn't mean that elites can't represent the needs of the economically disadvantaged. And I think that, you know, other politicians who may now be in a different place than that which they started would argue to you that, you know, they still understand working hard for a living.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Gary in Madison, hi.
Yeah, hi. Just a couple of comments. I agree with your guest. Bill Clinton came from very humble beginnings. And for heaven's sakes, the Clinton Foundation has probably done more to stamp out AIDS than any other agency in the world, and they've done a lot for Ebola. How in the world can he be criticized? And can she be criticized? They've done marvelous work since they've been in office. And he was a poor person to start out with. And regarding this Elizabeth Warren, you know, Fact Check has just recently gone through a lot of her statements regarding the trade and found them to be bunk, as President Obama said. She doesn't have her stuff straight yet. I do support Feingold. I'm kind of disappointed that he's siding against this trade business. But I'm just kind of sick and tired of this criticism of Clinton and the speaking fees. He's done such good things since he's been in office. Thank you. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Kathleen.
Well, you know, I think Senator Feingold would probably believe that he is staking out what is a relatively consistent position. You know, now that he has announced, he is going to have to start responding to the different issues of the day. And I think that his opposition to this trade pact is probably pretty consistent with the sort of somewhat, you know, I don't want to say lone wolf, that's not exactly the best, but, you know, he was never afraid to take a stand that may have been outside of his party's interest or, you know, what he saw as the political interest of the day. Now, it is the case that President Obama is receiving more opposition on the Trans-Pacific deal from other Democrats than he is from Republicans, right? I mean, that is generally the pattern. President Clinton had the same problem with Democrats in NAFTA in the 1990s. Senator Feingold is not outside the mainstream necessarily of many Democrats right now. He may be a bit outside the mainstream in his willingness to be vocal about it. But he does have that freedom being outside of office right now, and he is going to have to, you know, sort of start taking these positions if he wants to differentiate himself for 2016.
He made reference to the fact that her facts, Elizabeth Warren's facts, weren't correct. Do you know anybody? The report that came out today that she issued is really tough. Child labor, outright murder of union organizers have continued, not just a part of President Obama's watch, but it's been a part of these trade deals with other presidents, with Bush and with Clinton as well. Do you know of anybody who's done a really thorough examination of these trade agreements to find out whether or not they've been good things on the whole or terrible things?
Well, you know, I will say that as somebody who doesn't study a lot of economic policy, I can't point to anything that I would want, that I would say to the audience, you know, go look at X.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that I'm sure there have been these sorts of analyses done. I am going to come back to the idea that, you know, your partisan perspective is going to allow you to like the evaluations done by economists or policy people on one side of the aisle as opposed to the other side. So I'm sure that, you know, both conservatives and liberals can bring numbers to bear to say that NAFTA was good or bad. You know, I myself, you know, again, as a non-economist, can't really point to something that is definitive. But I'm sure it's out there.
KC in Green Bay. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I'd like to make a comment about Senator Johnson. But first off, most Democrats are going to distance themselves from Obama when the election comes around. They're not going to want to tie themselves down with anything that President Obama has either done wrong or figuratively done wrong. But I would like to talk about Senator Johnson and Mr. Feingold. As a veteran, a disabled veteran in the state of Wisconsin, I'm extremely disappointed in the way Senator Johnson has conducted himself while he's in office. He's never, never gone to veteran service organizations to ask them for information. We've gone to him many times in Washington, D.C., and in here in the state of Wisconsin. One of the big things we go to is get the VA funded appropriately and on time, which is a yearly battle in the VA. And he's always hesitated. He's never opened his arms to veteran service organizations. He's very pro-military. If you see him, most of his camera shots are with active duty military, which is great. We should support our military. But he really has little or no care for the veterans when they come back to the state of Wisconsin, especially when it comes to VA health care. He's never voted to fund VA appropriately, and it's very disappointing. I'm a career Republican. I voted for him. I will not vote for him ever again. And I'll take your response off the air.
Thanks for the call. Professor Dolan.
There's not much that I can add to that. I honestly can't say whether or not I can take issue with the characterization of Senator Johnson's commitment to veterans issues. I'm sure, you know, he would believe that there are efforts he has taken. He certainly has tried to be a little visible in the sort of hullabaloo over the Tomah VA hospital issue. That may be because he's trying to make Senator Baldwin look bad somehow, but I just honestly can't engage as to whether or not he has, you know, been a friend to veterans or not.
Well, I think you could say that perhaps neither party has a terrific record when it comes to taking care of veterans.
Well, you know, I guess I would say that there are people we can point to. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand comes to mind as somebody who has worked pretty tirelessly in the Senate for issues for military families and for veterans. It certainly may be that being able to come up with the name of one or two people who have been advocates does say something and might be condemning of the two parties. I guess I would say that, you know, with everything that's happened with all of the veterans hurt post-Iraq and Afghanistan, I guess I would like to suggest that we have not deserted veterans, but we certainly could do a better job, as we could do a better job on almost anything.
Mark in La Crosse, hi.
Yeah, I guess my comment is I understood when Feingold announced his rerun for the Senate that he put in the front of that he wanted to work in a bipartisan way, and I thought to myself the way the Senate and the Democrats took over, they pretty much locked the Republicans out of the process and passed a health care bill that did not have the majority of the support of the public at the time, and he was part of it. The other part I would be interested is what his stance was on the foreign policy decisions that Obama went forward with, because they turned out to be quite a disaster as far as the Middle East is concerned. And that earlier caller, as far as former President Clinton, his speaking fees went up dramatically after his wife was named Secretary of State. I think it was like 7 out of the 9 went up to the $500,000 mark, and it didn't go to the foundation. It went to his personal income. So, and I've heard that the foundation, from a foundation standpoint, that 84% is gone towards staff and overhead accounts. From a nonprofit, how does it rate as far as the money going to the recipients that it's taken in? I heard it's not rated very well as a nonprofit.
Yeah, I don't know if we have information on that, really, but thanks for your call, Mark. Kathleen?
Yeah, I can't speak to any of those things. Those sound to me like, again, one side of the aisle says X, the other side of the aisle says Y. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's been an independent audit of the foundation and where it stands and how it's evaluated. That's not my area of expertise.
Al is next in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
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 Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I watched the Roosevelts last night.
Oh, what'd you think?
Well, I've seen it before, but it's just excellent. And talk about history repeating itself. Last night they talked about TR versus J.P. Morgan and the coal strike and all the high rates that they were charging for everything on the railroads, okay? And the statement that he made is that you rich people don't have any more rights than the poor people. Wow. You know, and then as far as Rush Feingold versus Ron Johnson, I mean, you know, that's a joke. Ron Johnson's still a climate denier. And I'm looking right here at a picture of Elizabeth Warren in 2010 Rolling Stone magazine, and a giant picture of what's called Petcoke behind her. And it's in the shadow of the old Sears Tower in Chicago. A pile of Petcoke, the world's dirtiest energy source, sits on the outskirts of Chicago where it awaits shipment above. Senator Elizabeth Warren is a key opponent of the White House's support of dirty energy exports, you know. I mean, God bless her. The country's run by crooks. The Supreme Court is a bunch of crooks. Citizen United is just something that TR would have been all over, man.
Thanks for the call. An unhappy American citizen, Professor Dolan.
I didn't hear a question there. I heard some reaction and some comments. And
right.
Going to leave it there.
All right. Thank you so much, Al, for your call. Our phone number, and we're doing all things political, which we always have on the air on Mondays at 1 o'clock. Professor Kathleen Dolan is our guest. She is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Our lines have been pretty crowded. And so now they're not. So call us now and let us know what you think about all the political news we have been covering. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. The U.S. Supreme Court today rejected this bid to stop an investigation in Wisconsin into possible unlawful coordination between potential 2016 Republican presidential candidate Scott Walker's gubernatorial campaign and conservative advocacy groups. I'm not sure if Professor Dolan is aware of what happens now, because you don't know, it's hard to keep track of what courts are looking at what. Evidently, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is considering separate cases concerning whether or not the investigation should continue, but the U.S. Supreme Court today said it should not be stopped. So where does that put everything? We'll ask her that, and we'll take more of your phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Kathleen Dolan is here now for All Things Political, Willem and Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering about, you know, the political candidates in this presidential race and their views on climate change and whether those have any sway with the voters. Hillary Clinton recently said that she called climate change the most consequential, urgent, sweeping collection of challenges that we face. Ron Johnson wrote me a letter that he says it's an unproven science and that it would be economically irresponsible to address climate change. And at the same time, he speaks about, you know, how much he cares for our children's future. So to me, those seem like kind of a bizarre that he holds both those views. But I was just wondering what you thought of this. You know, Governor Walker has declined to state it one way or the other, which I also think is very interesting. I mean, it's one of the major issues of our time, according to, you know, international scientists, and a person that's running for president refuses to even address the issue. So, anyway, I was just wondering what your opinion was on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find so fascinating about the 2016 election so far is just how many candidates there are, particularly on the Republican side. I would say that of the announced candidates at this point, and I think we can include Governor Walker in there because we know he's going to announce eventually, most of them hew pretty close to the sort of classic Republican Party line, that climate change is not caused by man-made activity, that it is an unproven set of assumptions, that, you know, the science is weak. I think, you know, you could say that Rand Paul probably is slightly farther toward the moderate position on that. He's not quite a straight-out denier of the science behind it, but one of the things we have to keep in mind is that at this point in the process, the candidates are speaking to their primary electorates. They have not yet decided that they have to make the shift to try to court the general election voter. So whether each of those individual 12 or 13 women and men on the Republican side truly believe in their hearts that, you know, there is no such thing as climate change, that the science is weak, is not something we're going to learn at this point. What we're going to hear is what they want the Republican electorate to think about their position. So we're going to see perhaps some shading, perhaps not a full-throated denial in the way that, say, Senator Johnson may do it. But they will certainly hew much closer to the idea that it is not man-caused.
I wanted you to respond to the U.S. Supreme Court deciding today to leave intact this federal appeals court ruling that overturned an earlier federal district court decision halting the investigation into possible coordination between the gubernatorial campaign of Governor Walker and conservative advocacy groups. This goes on and on and on. Was this a significant problem for the Walker campaign, or will this drag on for a long period of time and go way past the prime campaigning time?
Well, you know, there are a couple of answers to that. So the decision that the Supreme Court made today, in which they declined to hear the case, was simply them literally saying, we're not getting involved. The Federal Court of Appeals, when it overturned the federal district court judge, Judge Randa, in his decision, what the appeals court was telling the district court was that it was a state issue, it wasn't a federal issue. And so the appeals court was suggesting that Judge Randa had mistakenly involved himself and mistakenly decided when it really wasn't a federal issue, it was for the state to decide. So the Supreme Court is really affirming the circuit court's position that this is not a federal issue. So from the federal system perspective, you know, that process is done. But that does not negate anything that's still cooking here in the state. And there are the couple of cases that are still bubbling before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I think there may even still be one. Is it in Waukesha County? Or there's another sort of lower level court in Wisconsin that's also still hearing pieces of this. This might continue to become a problem for the governor to the degree that it does not end the process. It continues the litigation. We'll have to see how the Supreme Court handles the couple of different cases and the lawsuits that it's hearing. But at the same time, it may not hurt him to the degree that anybody outside of Wisconsin is hearing a thing about this. You know, we are right, sort of soaked in it, and so we all follow it and know a lot about it. But this doesn't appear to be following him out into the world, and the vast majority of Republican voters probably have not heard very much at all.
Mm-hmm. Ruth in Milwaukee, hi. Ruth, are you there? Call us back. Ron in La Crosse, hi.
Yes, I'd just like to make a comment. You know, we always talk how Congress seems to always be beholden to vested in special interests. Well, when anyone walks into a congressman's office or a state legislator's office or any elected official's office, even local, I think the congressman or elected representative, whoever, should view that person as just a common citizen, a constituent. And I think that's the only way you can represent people, but the constitutional way, whether it's a federal or state constitution. This business of, the government, whether federal or state, being a caretaker for big oil or any other business, I think it's just inappropriate. And I also like to make a comment about the Clintons. There seems to be a pattern of corruption all through their careers. I mean, way back when he was governor, there was the Whitewater scandal, which most Americans have forgotten because more or less the news media lets that amnesia occur. Then, and then there was supposedly a scandal involving cocaine smuggling into the state. And I think the Citizens United film dealt with that and the deaths of some young boys who witnessed a landing, a cocaine smuggling operation.
Yeah, I'm not sure where you're going with that. I don't know if any of that's been verified or treated legitimately. Professor Dolan?
I'm with you on that one, Kathleen.
Yeah. Let's go to Gene in Madison. Hi, Gene.
Yes. My question is for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, why would Republicans support something which, just as with the common market, there is a clause in the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership in which citizens can move to another country to work? That means Brunei or Vietnam, a citizen, if they could get a job in America, they could move to America legally, or Mexico could move to here legally, and we, of course, could move to Mexico or Brunei or Vietnam. And this seems to be totally contradictory to other positions people have taken. Why does not the media cover this?
One thing I would say is that most of the Republicans who are supporting the TPP are doing so because it is, you know, at least at top level, consistent with their perspective on open trade and economic issues. They're probably supporting it in part because lots of the sort of business titans and leaders of major U.S. corporations in the United States are also in support of this trade pact because it just gives them much bigger markets and audiences. I can't speak to the particular piece you're talking about with regard to citizenship. It's not clear to me what that is. And it is possibly the case that that is so sort of deeply buried in the bill that there may be people supporting it who are not aware of that particular specific provision.
No, I'm not aware of that provision.
Yeah, I don't take from the caller. I don't understand when he says citizens can go back and forth.
Right.
I need to know more. But, you know, love our members of Congress as we do. I think a lot of them have positions when they haven't read every word of a piece of legislation. And so they may take a top-level policy position without knowing every single thing that's in a bill.
Thanks, Gene, for the call. Pat, Three Lakes. Hi.
Hi. A few years back, when Governor Walker was running for governor of the state of Wisconsin, he thought he was talking to one of the Koch brothers, David Koch, I think it was. And during that conversation that he thought was David Koch, the individual that was being David Koch said, why don't you put a goon in there, a union goon or something? And I'm paraphrasing this because I don't remember the exact statement. And Governor Walker said, you know, I would, but I might get caught. And like I said, paraphrasing it, but if you read it, you would understand what I'm talking about. You think that's ever going to get out into the mainstream? And if it does, you think that people would vote for somebody that would actually state that he would put a goon in there if he wouldn't get caught?
Well, that was out in the mainstream, and all that was reported on, wasn't it, Professor Dolan?
It was certainly reported on when it happened before the first gubernatorial election, yes. You know, would it rise again during the primaries? Probably. If Governor Walker becomes the Republican nominee, it will absolutely get more airtime. And, you know, everything about his last, 5 years will be retread right out there. During the primary process itself, so far the candidates in the Republican primaries have played nicely with each other, really attacking, President Obama and maybe Hillary Clinton, more so than they are turning on each other. That may change as the number of candidates gets smaller and as we get closer and closer to both the start of voting and then the being able to secure the nomination itself. So it's certainly possible that could come up beforehand. But I think that's, I feel like a broken record, but people who would never have voted for the governor to begin with will be appalled by, that statement that he made to the person he thought was one of the Koch brothers. People who support the governor will find ways to say, oh, he was tricked, oh, it was a joke, oh, he didn't really mean it. I don't think we can underestimate the degree to which we can all justify or refute things based on our sort of partisan kinship with the speaker or the victim of, some criticism or statement.
How much does he have to have his policy objectives passed? What's happening, it seems to me, in the legislature is that some of his items Republicans are having to walk back on, long-term care, certainly education in the state, because so many people have expressed concern about that, so many mm-hmm. citizens of Wisconsin. Is that bad for the governor in his national campaign? How does he deal with that?
It's going to be interesting, actually. I have been interested to watch the Republicans in the legislature, who have to stay here and govern and who have to face Wisconsin voters in the future. And so I have found it interesting that they have decided that their interests do not always perfectly align with the governor's and that they need to protect their own interests as well as, they probably want to help protect his as well. If he doesn't get a lot of what he wanted in the budget, or if a lot of what he proposed was walked back by the legislature, it certainly isn't great for him. He wants to use right. his bold stance as governor as one of his primary tools for differentiating himself from all the other candidates. So if he is not as successful as he hoped, it doesn't help him. But it's hard to say. I mean, he'll get more than, he doesn't get. So mm-hmm. it's hard to say it'll be particularly damaging.
Professor Kathleen Dolan, thank you very much for being with us this Monday.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Kathleen Dolan is a professor of political science and chair of the department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. All things political you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. It's how we start the week talking politics. Only going to get more interesting as the days go by. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then Sister Pauline Quinn has a story that you will want to hear.